Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday, May 12th, 34 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning, and an absolutely splendid start to our morning with sunny skies and really no complaints so far as we head towards 60 degrees in Park City today. We'll see another huge increase in temperatures tomorrow after a temperature or low temperature around 40. We'll go to 70 for that daytime high tomorrow, and we'll more or less keep that 70 around into Friday. But we will start looking at more cloud cover into that Friday time frame, though we will be warmer. We also may get a isolated thunderstorm into the afternoon with that daytime heating. We'll be in the mid-40s for those overnight lows. On Saturday, we're starting to cool things back down a bit as we bring ourselves into the mid to upper 60s here for the weekend, with better chances to see some afternoon thunderstorms on both Saturday, but definitely on Sunday, where we are pretty assured that we're going to see the scattered storms out there and a high of about 65. We'll keep those mid-60s in play into next week, where we'll continue to have the threat for afternoon mountain storms, as well as we continue to just stay unsettled out there. But even if we see one or multiple storms, at least it brings some type of moisture to the area. So that's good news. But between now and Friday, it's going to get warm again, and it's going to be outside and enjoying it with all that sunshine.
All right, Adam. Thank you.
You bet.
KPCW News Time, 8:07. It's 8:08. Good morning. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bullo. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. And finally, thanks to the Chairman of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Thomas Cook, for jumping in. We had a last-minute cancellation from Wasatch County School District Superintendent Paul Sweat. And stay tuned, coming up right after the local news hour for the Mountain Life. Today's guests include Heather Curry from Communities That Care to talk about the mental health toolkit for our local youth, along with one of the panelists for the upcoming Ask Me Anything panel. Then Sophie Kohler of Park City Nursery talking about water saving and drought resistant plants and when, how, and where to plant this spring. Finally, psychiatrist Christy Montross will make it a presentation in Park City on Monday. She's the author of Falling Into the Fire, talking about the doctor's mind, inside the doctor's mind, illuminating the grave human costs of mental illness, as well as the challenges of diagnosis and treatment. All of that coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life.
This week on American Roots, we waltz and two-step across the musical landscape of South Louisiana. We'll hear historic tape from the late Cajun fiddler Dewey Bolfa, plus a visit with Zydeco guitarist Lil Buck Senegal, and I'll talk swamp pop with singer Rod Bernard. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
American Roots here on Sundays on KPCW.
Taking a look at some local news now, the Heber City Council adopted the North Village Overlay Zone in a 3-1 vote at their March 16th meeting. A group of residents wants to overturn that approval through a voter referendum. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this report outlining the residents' concern over the so-called NVOS and the new Facebook site, Families for Heber, promoting the zone change.
A group of Heber and Wasatch County people has been collecting signatures to put a voter initiative on November's ballot, which would repeal the City Council's vote approving the North Village Overlay Zone code adoption. Heber City resident Trudy Simmons is one of the founders of the Friends of Heber Valley Facebook page. She said the approval of the zone change would allow more density than initially allowed by Wasatch County. She's also concerned about environmental impacts and believes a voter referendum buys more time for further study. An opposing group on the Facebook page called Families for Heber promotes the passage of the NVOS. Simmons said they're using scare tactics to encourage residents not to sign the petition. 3,000 signatures are needed by May 23rd to qualify for the ballot initiative. According to their Facebook post, Families for Heber hosted a community open house Monday night to promote the benefits of adopting the NVOS and the subsequent development that would be allowed.
This is kind of a bogus group. They are just a group of developers who are obviously feel very threatened by the citizens' referendum because because they've mounted quite an effort to combat the referendum and try to get people not to sign it. In fact, they've sent out some very misleading material. One of their flyers that they sent out said, if you sign the referendum, this will happen. And there's a stock photo from who knows where of hundreds of houses pretty much stacked on top of each other. And then if you don't sign the referendum, this will happen. And there's a picture of, you know, sort of a babbling brook going through the open countryside.
Simmons said by signing the petition, neither of those things will happen.
All that will happen if you sign the referendum is that the people of Heber will be given the chance to vote on the zoning code for the North Villa in November. It won't cause anything to be built or anything not to be built.
Heber City Council member Rachel Kaler has posted the developers' names who are behind the Families for Heber group on her Facebook page. She provides details outlining the benefits of the NVOS, such as open space, density, environmental protection, tax-based revenues, and impact on downtown Heber. The land in question is currently within Wasatch County jurisdiction, but four annexation requests have been submitted to the Heber City Council by landowners and developers. Heber City Council member Mike Johnson said he does not like the misleading social media and PR campaigns by the Families of Heber or the Friends of Heber Valley.
Well, I did think the flyer was really poorly done. The flyer that passed out by the Friends of Heber Valley is also misleading and wrong. It shows that the city's granting substantially more density than is currently allowed in the county. Completely false. Our ERU count is underneath. The county's ERU count is, I think, 2140, and we're at 2080. So
Johnston said increasing density around the college would be a lifeline to keep Utah Valley University in Wasatch County.
And if we can't support them, and they desperately need the support we're offering, and they're so happy about this, but if we can't get this done, there's a very good chance that whole campus is just going to close and it'll never come back. It's been 20 years since that's come here, and we haven't been able to get it over 300 kids at the highest point. You know, we're down to like 80 right now. You know, if we don't want UVU, then the best way to kill it is to do nothing up there.
Johnson said the North Village zoning through the county allows commercial development along the highway and emphasizes high-density, mid-rise, and high-rise housing. He said the infrastructure is in place and the water from the Jordanelle Reservoir. The voter initiative, if passed, to overturn the NVOS would throw the development back to the county.
The city's planning ahead for this being in the city, and because the impacts will accrue to the city. So if the impacts are going to accrue to the city, the benefits and the sales taxes and the property taxes and the transient room taxes, all of these should also accrue to the city so we can have synergy with downtown, not a competition with downtown. So we can use best practices in our architectural designs and our open space requirements and our parks and trails. It all needs to be in the city without any input, without any ability to direct how it looks, without any taxes, without any income. We'll just have to deal with it. It'll be our Kimball Junction on the edge of town.
Simmons said if people are interested in helping gather signatures to qualify for the ballot, they should call 435-200-5721. She said the deadline to collect 3,000 Heber City resident signatures is the weekend of May 22nd and 23rd. Heber City Council member Mike Johnston urges residents to go to the city's website to learn the North Village Overlay Zone's details and its impacts on future development. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time, 8:15. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we've reported, after an 11-year stint at the helm of the Summit County Health Department, Director Rich Buell, retiring as of August, he joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. So the story is you intended to retire and then a pandemic got in the way?
Yeah, pretty much. I actually had always hoped to retire at 62. And 62 was a year ago this past February, and as the time approached, honestly, I knew that I wasn't ready to retire, and so I was anticipating delaying, but then when I saw that there was a pandemic headed our way, that decision became pretty easy. I didn't want to skip out on it. I basically wanted to be a part of the response and certainly didn't want to be viewed as having bailed before we gave it a shot, so here we are.
Okay, but it's time to leave then, huh?
Yeah, it's hard getting my head around it. I've been doing this for a long time, but you know they say that you'll know when it's the right time, and it's the right time. This feels good to me, and I'm looking forward to my future. I anticipate I'll probably surface after I rest up a little bit, and you know I'm I'm looking forward to maybe doing some volunteering for nonprofits or, you know, something along that line. I'm certainly not going to disappear.
Yeah. Now, the Board of Health met in a special meeting Monday announcing that the job was being offered to Deputy Director Phil Bondurant, of certainly well-qualified. But I guess why the rush? I mean, a special meeting and all, we've got months before August.
Well, it's not really a rush. I announced in closed session that I was intending to retire in August, and this was back in February. But that I did not want to make that public, and this was my decision. I did not want to make that public until May. I didn't want the disruption. We were back in February. You think about where we were in the pandemic response. I didn't want that disruption, and so, you know, I let let the county manager and the council know. And really, the process began back then to determine how to move forward. And if you think about, so I announced in May, 3 months away, roughly. That's actually not a lot of time. It's not much time to recruit a position like this, and it's not much time to transition. So, I think a big part of the intent is consistency, and we're still in the middle of this response in a very different capacity. But we're also coming out of a really disruptive event in our community and our county and our health department. And so I think continuity is really important as we plan what we're going to be moving forward, what the community wants the health department to be. And we needed that experience. We need somebody who knows the department and has really been in the trenches with us. And Phil absolutely meets those standards.
And my understanding is that the board decided that it would not post the job, knowing that it had an excellent candidate in Phil Bondurant. But as a recipient of federal funds, isn't the county required to post a job under EOE requirements?
No. And we actually confirmed that. We had our legal look into it, and then Dorothy Adams also, who was the deputy in Salt Lake County, deputy health officer in Salt Lake County, had their attorneys look into it as well, just for confirmation. And indeed, there are no requirements.
All right. And I guess just with so much emphasis these days about diversity and equality, I mean, I'm looking at the last two of the three jobs filled by the health department, again, have gone to white guys, Derek Moss and, of course, Dr. Bondurant. And, you know, we saw the same thing at the Park City Council when it named Matt Dias as city manager. I mean, the job not even posted, not even offered to others. So don't we have some responsibility there, just in terms of at least looking?
Well, I think we certainly do, but if you've got candidates that are, first of all, internal, you know, Derek Moss was the nurse at the jail, and he knew public health. We'd worked with Derek as a health department for years. Carolyn Rose and Derek worked really, really closely together. And so he was, you know, in our view, a slam dunk when he applied, and it was really an opportunity, an internal opportunity for him to advance his career. And you know, that's a county philosophy. That's a core of what we do. We want to be able to promote, advance, and provide opportunity internally. In many ways, Phil's the same way. You know, he's a known entity. It's an opportunity internally, and both candidates were a perfect fit. I do want to point out, you know, the health department is predominantly female. You know, the perception that we're hiring white guys, as you say, I don't believe is accurate. If you look at early intervention director, WIC director, health promotion director, you go down the list, female. So that's generally public health. That's true at the state health department as well. So the perception that, you know, this is any sort of a biased selection process, I don't think is accurate.
Yeah. And in terms of just given that the number of residents that we have who speak Spanish, I mean, I know that KPCW certainly has had a difficult time finding even having an applicant who speaks Spanish. I mean, are you facing this similar issues? I mean, just not having that bilingual capability?
Well, we do have the bilingual capability. I think it's accurate to say we don't have it in leadership at the health department. But we recruit very actively Spanish-speaking individuals, in particular in positions that interface with the public a lot. But absolutely, it's a major concern. And if you look at behavioral health, for instance, there are huge shortages of practitioners of behavioral health who speak Spanish or are bilingual. So it's a big deal. I will tell you that for certain positions, behavioral health is a really good example. I think the issue needs to be addressed further up the curve. There needs to be incentives for people who speak, in particular Spanish, but generally people who are bilingual, to go to school, to become a counselor, and to become certified and licensed. I think it starts way upstream, and that's one of the things that I believe we need to work more diligently towards.
All right. Summit County offering, it sounds like, just a handful of vaccine clinics at the film studio. After that, then where do people go?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, the reason that we're wrapping up at the film studio is because demand is way down. And also, you know, the film studio, they've got clients now. They've got paying clients. And shout out to the Crandall family again, Gary Crandall family, for letting us use that incredible facility. It has worked really, really well. We are standing up multiple clinics. First of all, vaccines are available in all of our health department offices, so Colville, Camas, and Park City. Fresh Market has vaccines, Walmart, Walgreens, there are other vendors. Intermountain is still doing vaccine clinics. Those are wrapping down, again, because of decreasing demand for first doses. And at both Intermountain and at the film studio, we're right now focusing on second doses. We're also doing some mobile clinics. So, for example, for youth at the schools, we're going to be doing a mobile clinic in Colville on this Saturday. And those clinics are, it's a third party. It's not being done by the health officer, the health department. It's a third party by the name of NOMI. They do a great job. So that's the direction. We're going to try to make this stuff more available, more convenient. The way I'm visualizing it, I stopped by Fresh Market a little bit ago, and it dawned on me I hadn't had my shingles vaccine. And so I just asked them if they had a dose, and they said, yeah, and I got my shot. I didn't make an appointment. It was easy, and it was spontaneous. And I think that's more and more the way this needs to be.
Yeah. In terms of the Utah Film Studio, did the county have to pay rent for that, or was the space donated?
The space was donated, which is flat-out remarkable. I mean, it was... You know, this isn't a competition, but as I compare our facility and what was offered to us at the Utah Film Studio, there was nothing else like it in the state. It was just perfect, and the timing was perfect. The volunteers were incredible, and so we couldn't be happier. Our vaccine rates are through the roof, by far the highest in the state of Utah and among the highest in the country. And part of that is not just us and that facility, but also all of the partners who are providing vaccines to people who live in Summit County throughout this entire event.
Yeah, what is that percentage then in terms of the highest in the state of Utah?
Well, so first of all, keep in mind these are estimates because we don't have an exact census population. So we've actually built in. We've added about 3% to the census numbers that the state is using to calculate where our vaccine uptake is. And the reason we've done that is because we knew that people came here during the event itself, during COVID itself, to escape cities. And so we think our numbers, our denominator has been a little bit low. So even after adding that 3%, 70 plus is at 91% first dose, 91% complete. 65 to 69 is 96% first dose, 84% complete. 50 to 64, 95 and 77. And everybody over the age of 16, so everybody eligible in the county, 85% have a first dose and 64% are complete. Those numbers they're better than I ever could have dreamt of. And kudos to the community for wanting the vaccine and finding ways to get it.
Yeah. And then what's keeping people away? Have you found out that?
Interesting. So Phil has actually been working with mayors and others on the east side, the LDS Church in Colville and some other partners, basically asking that question. And what we're hearing more than anything is that it's a matter of convenience. You know, people are working. They, you know, the idea of getting on and actually making an appointment, going through that process, coming to the film studio, it's been a barrier for some people. And so that's part of the intent of these stand-up clinics, is including having it in the health department offices. Just come on in and get a vaccine. And so we're hoping it's not going to be big numbers. You know, we're not going to get hundreds of people showing up in these pop-up clinics, but we're hoping that we can start to pick off 10 here and 20 there, and pretty soon those numbers will continue to increase.
All right. And, of course, as you mentioned, the announcement that Pfizer has been approved for emergency authorization for children 12 to 15. Should parents be concerned? I mean, I'm hearing a lot on the national level, you know, is that parents should talk to their kids to find out what they think rather than the parents just making the unilateral decision about whether or not their child is vaccinated or not.
I think that's absolutely good advice. You know, part of that conversation, a two-direction conversation, is all about education and making sure that the adolescent is comfortable with this. As far as safety, yeah, there were no... you know, Pfizer has really been ahead of the curve on these trials, and so they've done a full phase 3 trial, you know, well over 2,000 people studied. No contraindications, you know, typical side effects, a little bit larger on the second dose. Some of those were a sore arm, maybe a headache. But what's incredible is they're finding in that population, and first of all, it's a different approach. In these later groups, you don't vaccinate a huge number of people and then wait to see if they get sick or not. You actually measure whether or not they've had an immune response. And then you can calculate what that response would do as far as protection. So it's a faster process, but the safety part of it isn't faster. They have followed these adolescents now for months, and no safety issues. And what they have found actually is that the immune response is very strong in these young people. And this is the phase 3 trial, but they're saying nearly 100% effective in immune response. And so, you know, we all know that youth generally don't get as sick, but we also all know that they carry the disease and they spread it to higher risk populations. And so that's a big part of this. And I think it's a really important tool in keeping schools open and in place. You know, we've heard a lot that the schools, the students are not thrilled. The supervisors in the schools are not thrilled about having masks in schools. Well, if you don't want to wear masks, best bet is to get vaccinated if you're going to stay open. So this is a big part of that equation, and we're certainly encouraging those parents to have that conversation with the kids and make a determination on how to move forward.
Yeah, so what is the Pfizer? I mean, is it the same vaccine, just a lower dose?
No, it's the same vaccine. It's not even a lower dose. All they've done is they've modified the emergency use authorization to include 12 to 15-year-olds.
So when does that go away, that emergency authorization? At what point do we say that we have a real vaccine here?
So they generally go away when the emergency is over. And so we anticipate that when this disease becomes more endemic, something that just lives within our communities, like influenza, for example, that would go away, and then there would be the formal approval process to fully approve the vaccine. Importantly, and this is a really important piece of information, all of this emergency use has been going on. Part of it is the study. So they're collecting data this whole time, you know, as we know. And so approval will be relatively swift. You know, they're going to have a ton of data to make determinations, and it's been proven thus far to be a very safe vaccine. Really, all three, you know, the three that we know, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer, very few contraindications or complications.
So, in terms of just business in the county, I mean, is it back to normal? We can fill in those fitness classes, no masks here or there. I mean, special events are, you know,
with respect to state law, yes. Now that said, people still need to mitigate. They still need to be wise, and of course, that's been the argument from those people who haven't liked the orders all along. Is let us make decisions. Well, here we are. It's time for us to make decisions, both on the individual level, family level, and business level. And we need to be smart. This stuff's still around, and it is accurate that being vaccinated, having these high levels of vaccine uptake in Summit County, people who live in Summit County, is going to protect us. But as we know, we're a tourist economy. And, you know, I am watching and worried about and thinking about the big events that are going to happen this summer. We're far and away the highest vaccine uptake in the state. So when individuals travel from places like Utah County or St. George, which has, you know, St. George has a very low uptake, what's going to happen if they come here for big events? Are we going to have increases in cases? If you're a pocket, if you're part of a family, perhaps, that hasn't been vaccinated, you're going to be at risk, and that's not going away. So we still need to be smart, but there's a lot more choice involved at this point in time.
The pandemic has certainly been all-consuming for the Summit County Health Department for the last 15 months or so. What has been kind of left by the side here that didn't get done as a result that needs to, that will be focused on now that you've kind of got that behind you?
Yeah, I actually completed a survey yesterday for the state, for the legislature. All the health departments did that, and it was focused specifically on that. You know, what services have taken a hit? First of all, we kept, if you look at our core programs, so early intervention, WIC, clinical services, environmental health, health promotion, we kept some semblance of all of those programs going. But services were reduced, except in the cases where we could do them remotely. And I failed to mention a couple of programs. One of the big ones is behavioral health. We still did the programs, but a lot of those services went remote. And so where we find ourselves now is how and when are we going to be phasing into in-person visits? The vaccines are a critical part of that. If you think about the early intervention program, it's literally a home-based program where our clinicians go to homes. It's concerning to have them going into homes that may or may not have been vaccinated. And we don't know that, and we're not going to ask it. And so some of this, you know, we may never go back to completely in person, completely what we consider as normal. Because, for example, our WIC services have increased. They haven't decreased. We're going gangbusters on that, early intervention as well. So we're going to do business differently, and that's part of the process. That's one of the reasons that, you know, somebody like Phil, who's been through this, can sit and look at specific programs moving forward and say, and this is where we were. This is where we were during the pandemic, and now this is where we need to go, and this makes sense. So we're going to redefine ourselves, and I think that's going to be a really exciting process. And we've got a staff, you know, we've got an incredible staff. And so I'm very confident in what's going to come of all of this.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention? I'm about out of time here.
Well, the last thing is just a shout out to the community again. Our vaccine numbers are what they are because of the community. People wanted the vaccine. They got the vaccine. And here we are, and our case numbers are great. We've got one of the lowest positivity rates, around 2%, low case rates. Things are looking really good. And so that's, you know, we've worked hard to provide what we've provided, but ultimately it comes down to the community wanting to be a part of this. And it's just remarkable. 490 volunteers, by the way, at the Utah Film Studio, almost 16,000 hours. It's been remarkable, and I can't thank people enough.
Okay, Rich Bolla, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Summit County Health Director Rich Bolla, you're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. News time now, 8:35. It's 8:36 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher with the Park City Council meeting in work session Thursday, starting at 4 o'clock in the studio with a preview. I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Sorry, I'm a little out of breath. I just ran down the hill. I apologize.
let's see. The annual budget process starting, and we'll get a look at the tentative budget for fiscal year 22. After amending the fiscal year 21 budget a handful of times over the last year, it sounds like we actually did better than expected.
Very much so. That's been the silver lining all along, is we've had a very strong recovery. We had strong visitation this summer, and then incredibly in strong visitation this winter in the light of everything. But so this next year, you know, we're going to try to use that success and that stability to invest more in our projects, our programs, and our people. We know that this council and community have very strong and aggressive goals, and we're going to try to create a budget that can serve those up and forward some of our initiatives.
So it looks like, and again, I mean, I'm not the numbers gal here, but it looks like we ended up cutting the budget fiscal year 21 by $8.4 million. With all of the money coming from the federal government, have those cuts that we made then been made up and even more than that? I mean, looks like the pandemic may have served us very well financially.
Well, you raise a very good point. You know, I will say that the budget for next year is probably our most complicated to date for a variety of reasons. You know, first is our baseline is relatively low, but given the economic impacts, we had cut our budget in FY21. And then we have a separation with Summit County where we're, you know, diverting our transit systems, and so that allocation is no longer in our budget planning. In addition, we had an infusion of CARES money, the federal money that came in last year. And while we are budgeting for some money in FY22, not nearly to the extent that we were able to receive last year. So to further complicate matters, we're also using some impact fees that we've been building balances over a number of years to reinvest in some of our recreation facilities. So you have a sort of an immaterial baseline or a very low baseline given what happened with the economy. You have less CARES money. We're separating with the county. And then we're using impact fees in a creative way we haven't before. All that leads to a sort of murky comparison from one year to the next.
Yeah. So can we save that CARES money for a rainy day, or does it need to be spent?
It needs to be spent. It's pretty heavily regulated. Our intent would continue to be, you know, plowing it into investments that support those that are in need in our community, either nonprofits or our most vulnerable, our small business community. And we may have a capital project, too, where we're trying to prevent, you know, renovating a municipal facility by creating a shared workspace. So, for instance, we may take a wing of City Hall and create a shared workplace where we can have, you know, get away from the old system of everyone gets their own office or their own cubicle and have more shared workspace for our younger workers that are coming up from Salt Lake or working on the Wasatch Back.
Oh. So, I mean, is that like some demolition work then?
Perhaps. I mean, it's a historic building, so we treasure it and we treat it with great care. And I'm probably speculating more than I should, but we have almost $1 million allocation budgeted for CARES money, but time will tell. So if we don't receive that money, we'll have to come back and amend our budget. But that's currently what we're projecting.
Yeah. I heard from Ski Utah Director Nathan Rafferty, this could be a record year in terms of skier days for the state. I mean, and if that's the case, I mean, it sounds like we had to do okay in terms of sales tax, given that we've got the largest resort in the country.
We did. In fact, we just received our February numbers not too many weeks ago, and we were barely down. I mean, we were just basically comparable with last February. And that just, it's almost just hard to believe if you think about the uncertainty, the travel regulations. I understand things have gotten so much better in terms of health and human services with vaccination rates. But in February, we were in a much different place. The world's changing fast. But we, you know, we are anticipating a really, really strong winter. And that's the reason we're creating an operating budget that's investing in things like traffic and transportation, peak day management, intersection management, all sorts of things like that, so we can respond to it.
All right. Council will be holding budget work sessions between now and June 17th. Final adoption on the budget scheduled to take place June 24th. If people have some say, they need to do it between like now and June 17th.
Yeah, pretty much every successive council meeting between now and that date, we'll be discussing the budget probably multiple hours. And then we also may have a special meeting in June. Sometimes, you know, there's an allocation for difficult decisions need to be made, or council's making cuts or wants to add programs. So there is a propensity there to sometimes hold a special meeting.
All right. Council will also get an update with regard to the 2007 walkability bond. The city still has about $5 million left over from that bond, and it looks like we're still talking about a Snow Creek crossing. We have been calling it for years Dan's to Jan's. I think it's now the Snow Creek crossing. But it looks like we're only putting $350,000 towards a multi-million dollar safe crossing project.
Well, I think at this point, that's the plan, because we're still in that sort of engineering and analysis phase. To take a step back, as you mentioned, you know, in 2007, there was a $15 million walkability bond, and the council and the community formed a sort of special commission to review projects and initiatives. I think we're pleased to say that we spent well over $10 million of that on a myriad of capital projects, things like the Comstock Tunnel, the Bonanza Tunnel, Comstock Drive sidewalks, all sorts of improvements. But there is roughly $5 million remaining. So we're reporting into council. We've developed some sort of guiding principles that align with the community values of shifting people out of their cars and trying to get them into their bikes and walking and riding transit, and then reconvening that citizens committee to help us review the projects that we would spend that additional $5 million on. So it's a little bit of rinse, wash, repeat. We're fortunate to have a $5 million balance. We want to reconvene that citizens committee, and they'll provide a recommendation with staff to city council.
Yeah, and looking at that, we've got $1.25 million going to the Arts and Culture District. In fact, the majority of those remaining funds are not part of the 2007 walk project. So, I mean, voters specifically voted for projects and getting certain things done. And I guess how can you come back 14 years later and say, no, we're going to spend it on something else?
You know, I think that's a fine question. I just don't know if it's a but. I think it's an and I don't want to, you know, oversimplify that it was constrained on the list of projects. So obviously a lot's changed since 2007. But so our concept is to come in and be very, very transparent about what was previously conceived and what was previously recommended by the Walkability Committee, and then have a new group of citizens and professionals evaluate whether that still aligns with our values. Do those trail connections still make sense? Is that the highest and best use of that money? Has the environment changed? Do we have a different visitation or a different type of economy going on in an area or a new neighborhood? And then realign and reprioritize those investments, but do so in a thoughtful way where you'd come back to city council in an open meeting and we do so transparently. So the plan is to include many of those people that initially laid those plans and laid that ground for us and make sure that that's still the best and highest use of our taxpayer resources.
Okay, so when does this group get reconvened?
Well, so we're hoping to kick it off very, very shortly. We're getting a little bit ahead of our budget process, but that's the reason we're doing this together. So if City Council likes this approach to reconvene the Citizens Committee, we plan to jump right in this summer.
All right, 5:15, the council will hear the latest on the city's efforts to build a contaminated soils repository there at Quinn's Junction. And I guess given the surprise and the criticism you have seen from the community and requests for extending the public input period, has the city made that request to the DEQ to extend that, or is it closed? And
So no, we haven't made that request. Our understanding, or the way I understand this process, is that there's a public comment period, and the UDEQ receives all sorts of comments from either stakeholders or individuals or professionals, and then they respond to those comments. So we'll have a thoughtful response period with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. But to take a step back, sometimes I wish I had your history, because I've been, you know, just reading all of the old minutes and all of the old notes with our Soil Commission and really digging into the history of Park City. And, it's lively and it's very, very interesting. And it's also it's environmentally sensitive. And so we feel as, you know, we're trying to make a responsible decision moving forward. It's clear that the community wants more information, wants more input. And in the 7.5 years or so that I've been working with this council, whenever that's happened, they've always sort of taken a pregnant pause, stepped back. And so staff's written a report where we think we can take the next 60 days, 70 days or so, and provide, you know, neighborhood meetings, stakeholder outreach, and then some broad public information sessions before city council would make any steps to move forward.
Yeah, but again, that is, and Matt, I mean, this is on you. I mean, as the city leader here, I mean, this is coming after the fact. I mean, the city is reacting to the resident criticism as opposed to being proactive. I mean, you and I mean, we've talked about this a couple of times. I know I've talked to City Council Member Tim Henney about it. I mean, we've done a few reports on it, but then nothing. And I guess this is the thing that really just gets residents, you know, hackles up. I mean, it's like, this is the kind of thing that the public wants to know about it. And I guess it's just like, now, was it just a total PR flop on the city's part? I mean, what happened here?
I don't know. I mean, I think we've had a lot of self-reflection, and I think it's a fine question, and I appreciate you asking it. We obviously have a lot going on at the city, and for the last year and a half, like you, I feel as though it has been out in the public. You know, we had a fairly comprehensive work session where we agendize all of our information ahead of time in accordance with, you know, Utah open meetings laws. That information streamed live. Those recordings are live. You interviewed me on KPCW. I went back and heard that interview and then had a follow-up interview with the council member. Subsequently, after receiving that direction and that analysis, we've reported in twice during council meetings. So typically when we get direction to go forward with the capital project, we'll receive that direction, put our head down. But this one, there's some sensitivity, so we've reported in now twice. I guess the lesson here is we can do more. We can always try to do more. We obviously didn't see this coming. And we want the public to know that we take this seriously. We understand that they feel that they were caught off guard. We obviously don't want that outcome. This doesn't help us. We've run around a little bit crazy over the last 2 weeks to try to figure out what happened. I don't know that we would have done anything differently other than maybe held some community meetings or neighborhood meetings that people weren't asking for or demanding at the time. So lesson learned, we'll always try to endeavor to do more, but absolutely thought that people were informed and we were reporting into council and I was doing interviews with you on the radio. So we can and will try to do better.
Okay. And again, you're taking a step back and going through a 2-month public engagement process, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, that just felt like there was enough misinformation out there. There were some robocalls that went out, some leaflets, and it does appear to be sort of some sort of dark political world that we're not really sure what that is. But at the end of the day, this is an important decision for our community. Longtime locals have been living with our mining legacy for decades, and we want to make a thoughtful decision that balances community needs, preserves our natural environment and our commitment to sustainability, and a financially viable decision for the organization and our housing plans and our arts and culture plans and our transportation plans moving forward. And we're committed to that. And so I've never seen this council want to charge forward when we get this level of feedback and outreach. And so happy to take a step back and re-engage.
Okay. Matt, anything else you want to add about the agenda real quick?
Not about the agenda. I was going to mention that we have a council retreat next week on Thursday and Friday, and we're going to have it at the library as usual in the community room. And we are having an in-person retreat, but we will be streaming the retreat live. So if people are, you know, still uncomfortable being in person or they haven't been vaccinated, obviously there's an alternative, you know, means or method to follow along.
All right. Do you have that agenda posted at this point?
No, it'll be posted on Monday.
Okay. Matt, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie. Appreciate it.
It's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with the chairman of the Stuyvesant Basin Planning Commission, Thomas Cook. The Stuyvesant Basin Planning Commission met last night in regular session. On the phone with a recap, Commission Chairman Thomas Cook. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up was a public hearing and possible action on a conditional use permit for a new community park located near an existing park in Trailside. Did the commission approve the CUP?
We did approve that CUP. Yeah, that's the referred to as the Amenti parcel, kind of at the top of the hill and down towards Trailside Elementary.
Yeah, it just seems so strange that we're building a park next to a park. That was the only location we had for it, huh?
Well, I don't know that it's that strange. I mean, I think, you look at the adjacency of the uses. That parcel had been marketed previously for home sites. So, you know, it's not weird to say we would put home sites next to other home sites. But I don't know. You know, the interesting thing last night is we had some conversations amongst the commissioners after the presentation about, you know, is it the right place? Is it the right size? And one of my fellow commissioners reminded us that, you know, we were looking at a CUP and Basin Rec owns the land. So I think we were concerned with, we're concerned with traffic, obviously, some grading issues, but overall, I think it was a pretty good plan for Basin Rec.
Okay, so you felt like you've mitigated any of the concerns that the commission had?
I think so. I mean, I think that it was brought up that parking, you know, parking on the street's always going to be a problem up there. It's going to be really interesting to see if Basin Rec and the county can work together to, actually encourage people to use the parking that's provided for the fields instead of just parking willy-nilly in the shoulder of the road up there. We did have an issue about, a new paved paved bike path reroute to connect to Trailside Elementary for, you know, the folks who currently use that, and an easement issue. But I think we got that squared away in the conditions of approval.
All right. Also, then a public hearing and possible action regarding another conditional use permit, this one for Rocky Mountain Power, a transmission line upgrade along State Route 224 between the Bonanza Art District substation and Bear Hollow substation. Did you get this approved?
We did, yeah. And that was an interesting proposal because obviously it's crossing jurisdictions from, you know, Park City Municipal into the county, and I think we did our best to cover our bases. You know, Rocky Mountain Power had come in with a transmission line upgrade about a year ago, and I think many of the issues that we had about the poles and the types and the height, the county did a good job of mitigating that last time around. So, you know, many of those things had been foreseen for this part, but I think the county portion of the transmission line is about 50 poles, about 3 miles. There were some discussions about, you know, would it be possible to bury that line instead of have it overhead? And we learned some interesting things about the cost to actually do that. So I think obviously we approved it. And I guess they have to do the same thing with Park City Municipal for that portion.
Okay. The commission, during public input, also heard from Seth Dramgul, a concerned resident about the Dream Peak avalanche mitigation fencing. What did he have to say? I guess maybe that you haven't heard before.
Yeah. Mr. Dramgul has spoken on the record before about that, you know, that project, and I think this is just what I think happened is he was able to speak with Director Putt at the county and understand a little more about about the complicated nature of the SPA, the development agreement for the canyons, and what's entitled, and and then how the underlying code applies or doesn't apply, you know, when there's something explicit in the SPA. But I think the positive takeaway is that everybody came away a little more informed about process and had some really good suggestions. For example, we had previously reviewed our code for critical lands, and avalanche slide paths are part of critical lands. So, a higher awareness of the public that we're actually working on those sections of the code now, and some really good suggestions to consider when we look at that again in a work session.
So there are other areas then that could be considered for such fencing?
My understanding is that there's quite a bit of private land outside of the Canyon Spa, but along that ridgeline, yeah, that potentially if we didn't act and have something that addresses it in the code, this could come up again.
All right. And I think one of Seth's concerns was that he doesn't feel like the code was correctly followed. Is there anything to that? I mean, he points to specifically 10-3-4. That in proposals where the community development director or designated planning staff determines that potential issues may arise or additional comment is needed from the community, a public hearing on the application may be scheduled with the Planning Commission. That wasn't done. Should it have been?
So what you're referring to is the noticing requirements and the hearing requirements for LIP, low impact permits, versus CUP, you know, which automatically would come to us for a public hearing. I'm not going to question the director's discretion. My personal feeling is that this project should have had a public hearing. I would have preferred that we had a chance to hear from the public and have everybody understand. But I'm not going to question the director's decision on that. It's water under the bridge at this point. We are going to look at that in an upcoming work session and examine and discuss, do we think LIPs need to have another layer of public input?
LIP is being what?
I'm sorry, low impact permit, LIP. We get stuck in these acronyms, you know.
Right, right. So, and it sounds like some kind of meeting is happening between the community development director and some of the stakeholders. Will the Planning Commission be part of that, or is that just be reported
you know,
to you?
I think that you know as much about that as we do in terms of what's been reported in the media that, you know, maybe there's some goodwill PR meeting being lined up between the county manager and the powers that be at Vail. But to this date, we haven't been told or invited to that. And I guess we'll see if it happens.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Thomas?
No, I think you know, we had a relatively light agenda. We still managed to take a couple hours to do two items, but that's kind of the way it goes.
All right. Hey, I appreciate you jumping in this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Have a great one.
That's the chairman of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Thomas Cook. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. News time now, 8:58.
Current and relevant information matters to let you know what is going on around you locally, nationally, and internationally. KPCW makes this happen with this nonprofit news organization. With underwriting, KPCW can get the message about your business to our informed and dedicated listeners. Want to support the Local News Hour and NPR's Morning Edition? We're looking for a few more sponsors. For information about this program and all underwriting opportunities, contact Emily at kpcw.org.
Well, we were scheduled to speak with Wasatch County School District Superintendent Paul Sweat through his assistant. He canceled yesterday, late afternoon. She claimed the superintendent and his leadership team were pulled into a student activity this morning and would not be available. We hope to get him rescheduled and then kind of find out what's happening with that ongoing investigation into whether Wasatch High School lacrosse team players actually did use racial slurs during last Friday night's game when a fight broke out, among other issues, including growth, collective bargaining, next year's budget, and a host of other issues. It's 9 o'clock. We've got 41 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Looking for a pretty nice day. Sunshine with a high of 60. Clear tonight, 41. Mostly sunny and 69 on Thursday. Friday, we've got mostly sunny with a high near 70. We're going to see increasing clouds with a 20% chance of a shower or thunderstorm Friday. Saturday afternoon, probably a better chance, they're saying now, on Sunday. Highs cooling into the mid-60s over the weekend. Stay tuned now for the Mountain Life right after headline news from National Public Radio. This is KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.